loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, Catalonia has declared independence with hundreds of thousands pouring into the streets to celebrate. However, a dramatic showdown looms as the Spanish central government prepares to reassert its control. Alberto Garcia Watson, former senior correspondent for Hispan TV, joins us for this discussion. And then a United Nations committee has thrown its weight behind the narrative that the Syrian government made the decision to deploy chemical weapons while its forces were actually winning the war through conventional means. Is this really true? Rick Sterling, an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement, joins the show. But first, we turn to Catalonia. Welcome back, Alberto.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Alberto, tell us what's happening right now.
Well, the situation is pretty much confusing at this point. As around 3 o'clock this afternoon, Spanish time, the Catalan parliament voted for declaring unilaterally the independence of Catalonia from the rest of the Spanish territory. At the same time, in the Senate in Madrid, Mariano Rajoy got the majority of his political party, the Conservatives or the Popular Party, to vote pro the implementing of the Article 155 of the Constitution, which will take eventually all the power from the Catalan Parliament, dissolving the Catalan Parliament and calling for elections that will take place on the 21st of December this year. So as I say, at the same time that thousands of people are celebrating in the streets of Barcelona, the fact remains that it has taken very little time for Mariano Rajoy's government to basically annihilate and dissolve all the dreams of those that wanted to have an independent nation and that has been dreaming with this project for the past 6 years, mostly 6 years since Mariano Rajoy actually arrived to power, which was the point in which Artur Mas, previous president of the Catalan regional government, asked for more self-government and better conditions for Catalonia, and they were denied over and over by the Rajoy's government. So this is basically the situation. A symbolic, actually, act took place in the Catalonian parliament, but very shortly after, all the sovereign dreams of the majority of the Catalan people have been dissolved by this decree and this implementation of the Article 155 that is going to leave basically the parliament without power in Catalonia and is going to be overtaken by Madrid.
Can you tell us what would a denial of independence look like? If the Catalonians are saying we are independent as of today and the Spanish central government says, no, you are not, how does this manifest itself? What's going to change in the coming days?
Well, in the coming days, what we're going to see is that the president and vice president of the Catalonia government are going to be swept off. They're losing their jobs. The main mayor, Trapero, which is the head of the Catalonia's regional police, tomorrow will be also retired, and they'll put somebody of their confidence. When I talk about somebody, I'm talking about the central Madrid central government. And basically, the dissolving of the parliament is going to leave without effect any law or any attempt of changing the situation that Catalonia lives today. Catalonia will remain inside of Spain by the force, and any attempt on doing different by the authorities in Catalonia will be responded, as we had seen in the past, with the use of force, with the use most probably of the paramilitary Guardia Civil forces, the Policía Nacional, and most probably the army. This is the situation now. As I say, this is merely symbolic, the declaration of independence. I don't even think that President Carles Puigdemont had ever dreamt with this situation taking place. As a matter of fact, last night, his project was actually to call for regional elections in the last moment, and after dialogues and conversations with the CUP, which is the so-called anti-system political party of left unity, it's that it was decided that eventually today was going to be voted in the Catalonian parliament, the independence declaration, which took place. But as I say, it took very short time for the central government to declare and the Senate, after a vote, which they won, of course, they have total majority, to eventually leave without any effects that independence declaration in Barcelona.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined by Alberto Garcia Watson and John Kiriakou here in our Washington, D.C. studio. We're talking about what's happened in Catalonia. Today, the Catalonia autonomous government declared independence by majority vote. The Spanish government invoked Article 155, which allows the Spanish central government under extraordinary circumstances to dissolve a regional parliament, to take control of it, to take control of its police forces, to take control of its bureaucracy. Alberto, I'm looking at a magazine, a website. It's called Marketplace, marketplace.com. I want to read the first paragraph to you and ask you to tell us whether you think it's correct. The headline is, "The big reason Catalonia wants to secede may be economic. It's one of the very richest regions in Spain." And here's what it says, first paragraph. "Catalonia, the northeast region of Spain with Barcelona as its capital, is preparing to vote on an independence referendum on October 1st. This was obviously written before the referendum. The region has its own language, a proud identity, and a history of repression by Spain. But culture and politics aside, many say the major reason Catalonia wants to secede is economic. Catalonia has the highest GDP out of all of the regions in Spain, and at 266 billion euros, almost one-fifth of the country's economic output." Do you think that description of what's driving this movement for independence is correct?
It's partially correct. It's partially correct, but we can't forget the fact is that Catalonia has the strongest identity in the Spanish territory. Already in the 30s, when we had the Republica, which the Republican system, when we had no monarchy, when the monarchy had to flee to France, actually, at that time, when it was declared, the regional government, with very high percentage of self-governing possibilities and budget, at that time, president of Catalonia, Lluís Companys, declared to a certain extent the so-called independence of a nation inside the Republican nation, meaning he was not totally independent. He was put in prison in 1934. Catalans are, to a certain extent, very different to the rest of the Spanish. They have a very strong identity. That's very, very sure. But at the same time, the economical part takes a very important place in this issue, because it is true that Catalans pay in taxes much more than most of the Spanish do. And what they get in return, especially in the past years, is very little. That's to be honest. It's actually very little in comparison to what they pay. Other regions in Spain, much poorer than Catalonia, pay less into the national tax system, and at the end they get the same or sometimes even more benefits from the central government. So to that extent, I have to say that that is one very important issue. But the historical issue, the identity of Catalans, having their own language, having their own traditions. I was in Catalonia just days before, in Barcelona, days before the attack in the Rambla street in August, at the end of August this year. And I have to say that when I walk around Barcelona, I feel like I'm visiting another country. And the positive point of view, Catalans are very different to the rest of the Spanish. They have a strong identity. However, they welcome very much any other people from the rest of the territories of Spain. The unemployment lower than in the rest of Spain, and is a much more of a rich territory. However, in Franco's dictatorship, Franco made very sure that a lot of investments were done in Catalonia instead of in the rest of Spain, Catalonia and the vast land, trying to attract the sympathy of those that actually were more nationalists and against the central ruling. So that is true that they have much more industry than the rest of Spain. However, as I say, the component of the economical part is very, very important, but at the same time, they have a very strong identity. And already the fact that Catalonia, together with the vast land, getting their regional self-governments in the 30s, were triggered very much indeed the coup d'etat that Franco started on the 18th of July, 1936, that derivated in 40 years of dictatorship.
Alberto, Madrid is calling for what they're describing as free, legal, and clean elections in late December. If such a huge majority of Catalans are supporting and endorsing independence, what does Madrid hope to gain from new elections if presumably people with the same point of view as before win these elections?
Well, it's going to make a real difference if these elections are called by the regional government of Catalonia, which at this point is not possible anymore, or if it's going to be organized by the central government. We know that the central government, ruled by the conservative Partido Popular, Popular Party, we know how they deal usually in elections. As a matter of fact, this comes very handy for the central government and the Popular Party, the Conservative Party of Mariano Rajoy, because it serves very much for covering up the big amount of corruption cases. The judges now, the tribunal has put the political party of Mariano Rajoy, president of Spain, under the lupa and under the magnifying glass, calling the Partido Popular of Mariano Rajoy actually beneficiary of the whole corruption, enormous corruption case that has been taking place for the past 15 years. The fact also that the pensions found that the Socialist Party left in 2011 with over 70 billion euros now is empty. The government, the central government, has emptied that fund and is going to make very difficult the payment of pensions and from here to 5 years' time. So it's a lot of things that at this point is distracting the attention of the Spaniards. And this really very much benefits the central government. And as I say, the central government at this point, the political party, Partido Popular, which only has the 8% of the votes in the latest regional elections in Catalonia, is hoping and dreaming with gaining more support and probably supporting the other conservative party, Ciudadans, who now leads the opposition in Catalonia. Could be that it changes the balance, which is now in the side of the nationalists, and will make the non-nationalists, the what we call here the Españolistas, the pro-Spain, the unionists, stronger in a possibility in elections. However, the polls have shown recently that actually the independentists will remain with the same power. A lot of votes from the PDeCAT, which is the party of Carles Puigdemont, will pass to the Republican left, which is the political party of the vice president of Catalonia, but eventually they're going to remain with the same support of the Catalanes, which eventually will give them again the continuance in the ruling of Catalonia. So it's not to be understood how could this actually solve the problem with Catalonia, but I believe that what is going to give the central government is time. They need time to solve this situation because they did not want to sit down with the president of Catalonia, as the president of Catalonia had asked in several occasions, to sit down, to postpone the declarations of independence, to dialogue and find a solution for Catalonia. Mariano Rajoy had no interest in this. He wanted to go the hard line, and this is the situation in which we are today, that the political party that only has an 8% of representation in Catalonia is going to govern Catalonia from Madrid with only the 8%, meaning the sixth fourth in Catalonia is going to be ruling that entire territory.
Brian, there's an interesting op-ed in on Bloomberg.com today in which a journalist who is in Barcelona says that the difference between this independence movement and others that he's witnessed, for example, in Ukraine, is that people in Catalonia wish independence. They don't necessarily demand independence. And what he means is that Catalonians are very peaceful people by their nature. They love life. They love to spend time with each other, and they're very family oriented, and they like to enjoy, you know, day-to-day life. They're not willing to die for a flag or to die for an idea. They prefer to be independent, but they won't go to their graves for it. Alberto, I wonder, do you agree with that? Do you think that's true? And if so, doesn't that sort of lead us to believe then that there's going to eventually be some sort of a negotiated settlement here?
To be honest, what you're saying is very much true. Catalans had never been so much pro the independence as now that Mariano Rajoy governs the national central government. The national central government of Mariano Rajoy has made possible that Catalonia has gained more and more independentists. The lack of dialogue, the lack of finding a solution and negotiating solutions for Catalonia has pushed a lot of people who were not pro the independence to become more radical in that aspect. To be honest, not even Carles Puigdemont in the 2015 regional elections had in its manifesto, in its campaign, electoral campaign, the independence as a subject. That was not even there. But the fact, as I said earlier, when Mariano Rajoy takes power in 2012, and the previous president, Artur Mas, the previous president of Catalonia, requests better conditions for Catalonia, and it was totally dismissed because at that point they claimed that Spain was about to be rescued by the European Central Bank, and they have brought 18 times to the Spanish Parliament a project to improve the situation in Catalonia. Otherwise, the independence will be the only way out. 18 times, the political party of Mariano Rajoy and his government totally denied any support and any dialogue with the nationalists. Of course, the government of Catalonia said, if they don't listen to us, we'll ask the population of Catalonia and we'll let them decide. And this is why it got this far, because actually the central government did not want to sit down and dialogue and find a possibility of reaching an agreement, which till today, the Catalan president had offered over and over to the central government. If it would have been a different government in Madrid, if it would have been the Socialist Party governing, for sure the situation would have reached what today we see, and for sure there wouldn't have been the amount of independentists in Catalonia as we have today.
That's Alberto Garcia Watson. We're talking to him from Madrid. We're talking to him about the decision by the Catalan regional government to declare independence today by vote, and then the invocation of Article 155 by the Spanish central government in Madrid, taking control of Catalonia, dissolving the Catalan parliament. Alberto and John, you know, it seems to me that when we are taking a look back, and we've covered this story a lot in recent weeks, there are two or three things that emerge. One was, the people in Catalonia did not necessarily want to separate from Spain, or at least not the majority. Secondly, most of the people in Catalonia were offended by the central government's decision not to let them have a voice in whether or not they wanted to be part of the central government, central state apparatus with Spain. They were also deeply offended by the heavy-handed use of police tactics on October 1st, trying to shut down the referendum, and thus those who actually were not for independence but for the right to vote for independence maybe moved more into the camp of independence because they were offended by the heavy-handedness. And then we have other factors, which are the orientation of the political parties within Catalonia itself. And as we discussed in the beginning with Alberto, there is an economic factor, and the economic factor is resentment in some degree, maybe in a large degree, from Catalonia, a richer region of Spain, that they're sending their tax money to the central government and seeing less of it come back in return, and having more of that money, perhaps, at least the perception being going to poorer people, less accomplished parts of Spain. In other words, that could also have a, you know, an element of class kind of chauvinism. We've seen that before, say in Yugoslavia, where the Croatians thought the Serbs and the Montenegrins, the poorer part of Yugoslavia, were getting too much. In other words, in opposition to affirmative action, or however you would want to put it on an economic basis. There's a lot of factors that have come together. But what I want to go back to, Alberto, is to put it into not just a countrywide context, but a global context, because Spain was the victim of the economic recession of 2008, which did not start in Barcelona. It did not start in Madrid, although Spain pursued some of the same real estate policies that helped sink the U.S. Economy in 2007-2008. And by Spain, I mean the banks and the real estate developers. Here we had, John, the Great Depression of Spain is what many people call it since 2008, almost 25% unemployment. That's the level that the U.S. had during the Great Depression of the 1930s. Catalonia had high levels of unemployment, over 22%, maybe lower than Madrid, but still higher than the national average. If it wasn't for the global capitalist economic contraction, recession, depression that brought everyone down, the issue over taxes and tax disbursement isn't such, it's not such a sharp issue because everyone's doing a little bit better. But when everybody is being somewhat impoverished, then people start to fight over what appears to be a shrinking pie. So I don't think we can simply look at politics or even the miscalculations of the Spanish government or the psychological factors going on in Catalonia, which are obvious, without also looking at the bigger, broad economic picture, because that's what really impacts people. Do you have a job? Do your kids have a job? Do your kids feel that they are going to have a better future? Do you want what you want? You want your kids to have a better future than you had. If all of that seems to be out of the picture, then people start to fight amongst themselves also and try to find some other road to salvation. Anyway, what do you think about all that, Alberto?
Well, you are very, very right in your thoughts. The crisis has done a lot. Especially in Spain, the precarious situation of the working class, seeing how the big money pays very little into the national tax system and is actually the working class that has to pay the most, seeing how political parties like the Partido Popular of Mariano Rajoy and even the political party of Carles Puigdemont are involved and deep cases of corruption. This pushes, obviously, the people to become eventually more and more radical. However, this basically has started with Catalonia ever since the conservative government is ruling Spain. This actually, the humiliating way in which the Madrid central government has been treating Catalonia has pushed most Catalanes that have voted for the independence to take this position. As you very well said earlier, Catalans are pacific people. They don't want war. They actually, the biggest demonstrations against the war in Iraq happened not only in Madrid, but also in Catalonia. They're the most, the solidarity with the refugees, the solidarity with causes like for example, the Palestinian cause. I remember I was one member of the Second Freedom Flotilla that was going to Gaza. And the group from Spain, actually more than half of the group was from Catalonia. And they were willing even to fight for actually people that were from very far away. We're not even talking about Catalanes. No? So Catalanes are actually the culture in Catalonia, the opera, palaus, the theater, the book fairs, everything. It makes them very different to the rest of Spanish. However, the way that Madrid has treated them ever since Mariano Rajoy had reached government in 2012, the way that they have, the way that they cause the economical situation to deflate in areas of Spain, but especially in Catalonia, they cut down in a lot of expenses. Catalonia had to close hospitals. They had to close universities. The austerity measures that were implemented by the Catalan government actually were provoked by what Madrid was sending them as a budget. This situation has pushed a lot of people. And not only that, last year we heard, we learned about the Ministry of Interior from Spain involved in a scandal where they were actually investigating the leaders of the independentist groups to try to find a possibility of creating a fake scandal to ruin their political careers. And that all paid with the tax money. We see how the central government has been acting all over Spain, because Spain has become a much poorer country than it was 20 years ago. Spain today, to be honest, I mean, we are the second country in children malnutrition in Europe after Romania. The juvenile unemployment in Spain goes over the 50%. It's very close to actually what the Gaza juvenile population has as unemployment, the Gaza Strip in Palestine. The situation in Spain has reached points of what everyone is expecting, that eventually is going to be a revolution if this continues like this, because especially we see that we have a 13% more of multimillionaires in Spain. But the thing in Spain is actually that those who could actually pay big amounts of money to the states actually have their money in Panama, they have it in Switzerland, they have it in the Cayman Islands. And that amount, which goes over 90 billion euros that escape out of the tax system here in Spain, is actually provoking. I mean, if that money will come into the tax system in Spain, we will not have the situation, the economical situation that we have at this point. And a lot of this has been actually, the Partido Popular of Mariano Rajoy has been taking advantage of it, not just in a regional government, but also municipal, local governments. They've been given licenses to construct to businessmen that actually were not entitled. They get enormous amounts of commissions. They paid and they finance actually elections with black money.
We're going to have to wrap it up. Alberto, we have run out of time. We have come to that point in our show, so sad, because we'd like to hear more from you, but we will. We're going to stay with this story. Nothing could be bigger right now than the independence movement in Catalonia and the reaction from Spain. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You're here with John Kiriakou and Brian Becker. We're going to be back in a moment after a short break. We're going to be talking about Syria, and then at the 5 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about the big stories of today. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The United Nations has thrown its weight, or some part of the United Nations, has thrown its weight behind the narrative that the Syrian government made the decision to deploy chemical weapons in April 2017 against rebel forces, even though the Syrian Arab Army was at that point winning the war through non-chemical weapons, through conventional means. We're going to talk about, is this report true? What's behind it? We're joined from the Bay Area in California by Rick Sterling. Rick is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Welcome back, Rick Sterling.
Yeah, hi, Brian.
The story, it's in the New York Times, it's in all the media. The Syria chemical attack, Assad regime forces behind deadly sarin explosion, finds UN report. A new UN report from the UN has found that the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad's forces, are to blame for a deadly chemical attack that killed more than 90 people in a rebel village earlier this year. Go ahead. I mean, this is a big allegation. If true, it would mean not only that the Syrian government said that it wouldn't use chemical weapons, it would also mean that the Syrian government, which had said It no longer has any chemical or biological weapons, was lying. And it also would have to make some sense tactically or strategically in terms of the military situation where the Syrian government seems to be on the verge of winning. Anyway, what's your take?
Well, the first step in an investigation normally is to look at who would benefit from a crime. In this case, the evidence suggests that the Syrian government is absolutely the one that would not benefit, and it's the opposition that benefits. So, you know, on that basis, one should approach these accusations with skepticism. One thing that's really striking about this news today is that they have not released the report. So if the evidence is so solid, if they're so convinced, and they actually don't say they know this, they say they're confident of it, which is an important distinction. But let's see the report. Why have they not allowed the world to look at this report if the evidence is so compelling? So far, they've restricted it to some governments that are at the United Nations, and they've given copies of the report to some Western media sources, such as the New York Times, which says they saw it. But there's a lot of other people who will look at this with a more critical eye. So let's see their evidence.
John Kiriakou, you worked at the United Nations. You were there attached to the U.S. Embassy for counterterrorism actions. What would be the reason that the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the U.N. agency on this topic, would release the report to some selected media outlets and not the public? Is there a reason?
There is a reason. It's going to sound slightly conspiratorial, but this is just a fact of life at the United Nations. The United Nations, for all of its money and all of its employees, doesn't necessarily have a very robust investigative arm. And so what it does is it relies on the intelligence services of member states to provide it with information. So my guess is, and this is an educated guess, but I don't have any firsthand proof of this, but my educated guess is that the United Nations... it's the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. My guess is that they used information from perhaps the CIA, MI6, Mossad, who knows, and came up with their analytic line and then released the information to the governments that provided the information and to friendly press outlets. So, As Rick points out, we really don't know what this report says. We don't know what the evidence is. The evidence is not being released to us. And it's yet another example where an organization in a position of authority says, take our word for it.
Rick, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has repeatedly denied that his government has any chemical weapons, no chemical weapon stocks, after agreeing to give them up to international monitors in 2013. And just for our audience to remember, John Kerry at that time, then Secretary of State, said that Assad had used chemical weapons, that that was crossing a red line that President Obama had established rhetorically. I believe with the idea that, of course, the Syrian government would never cross that red line and that would save Obama from the pressure to actually intervene militarily in Syria directly. But John Kerry said it was so. And then that was in August 2013. There was massive opposition, grassroots opposition all over the United States, all over the UK. The UK Parliament, in an almost unprecedented way in like more than 200 years, moved against the government and said, no, they would not give a blank check authorizing the use of military force by Britain to join with the United States in a war in Syria based on this evidence that Syria had used chemical weapons. And then at the last minute, Russia stepped in and offered a face-saving measure for Obama by saying, look, Syrian government is willing to give up its any biological and chemical weapons, put them under international monitors. They would thus then be destroyed. Obama could say, yes, I'm not going to bomb Syria, but as a consequence, we got this big concession from the Syrian government. And then all the rest is history. I mean, now you have a situation where Assad said, okay, we gave up the chemical weapons, we gave up the biological weapons, we gave them up to the same entity. which included these UN monitors, we don't have them, and repeatedly denied that we would use them and said it doesn't make sense for us to use them because if we were to use them, that would invite foreign intervention. The only thing that would prevent Syria from winning this war that began in 2011 would be U.S. military intervention. So then, of course, as you've said, the incentive isn't there for Assad. But is it possible that there was an accident? I mean, is it possible that the chemical weapons, I mean, it appeared that people were impacted by chemical weapons. Like, if the Syrian government didn't do it, who did do it?
Well, the ones who have benefited from this is the armed opposition and all of those people who want to continue the war in Syria, who are desperate to stop the war coming to a conclusion with the defeat of the armed opposition. They're the ones who stand to benefit from it. But if we look at, what happened there and. You know, it's good you're giving that history, Brian, because it was not just Syria that claimed that they gave up all their chemical, the sarin that they did have. It was the sarin was actually destroyed on a U.S. Vessel. And they were, of course, carefully monitoring all of that and getting the chemical identity of that sarin gas in case they could point to its use in the future. So, and in fact, the OPCW got a Nobel Prize for their role in monitoring and overseeing the destruction of the complete chemical weapon arsenal that Syria had. So after that happened, and then in 2015, there were a lot, since Syria, it was generally acknowledged that Syria had given up all of its chemical weapons, then we heard about chlorine gas bombs being used by the Assad government. Never mind that regular bombs are much more deadly than chlorine gas bombs, which go back to World War I. Because it is a chemical weapon, the allegations were out there, and actually there were a lot of accusations in March of 2015 that Syria had used chlorine gas, and at the United Nations and elsewhere, the U.S. was on the warpath, claiming that Bashar al-Assad was again gassing his own people. I looked into that, and the evidence was extremely flimsy. And basically, they rely on eyewitnesses, usually reporting in Turkey, which of course has been a major supporter of the war of the armed opposition in Syria. They rely on eyewitnesses who are recommended to them by an opposition group, and that's their evidence. They basically, do interviews with people in Turkey. So it's a very biased kind of report. Now, coming forward to the attack on April 4th, the events in Khan Sheikhoun, there have been a number of studies that came out subsequent to that. One was by Seymour Hersh, and he disclosed that the U.S. had actually known that the Syrians were going to be doing an attack on an arms depot in that town because the Russians, in collaboration with the Syrians, provide that information to the U.S. Air Coalition. So Hirsch talks about how this was a massive fraud and that U.S. knew there was going to be an attack. And his speculation was that what had happened is there was chemical weapons in the arms depot of the opposition at that location. Professor Adam Postel from MIT, he did a detailed study which showed that the evidence, the photographic evidence and other evidence that had emerged indicated that the bomb that was shown in photos, basically a crater in a road with a fragment of a bomb, the evidence suggested that it had been put there and exploded on the ground. There's another investigator who's done a very good report, Syria Sarin Allegation, How the UN Panel Report Twists and Omits Evidence. That's a bit of a mouthful, but interested people can find it online. Adam Larson published at The Indicter, and he's investigated this, and he's shown how the evidence that this independent panel came out with in September of this year, they ignored all sorts of contradictory evidence, such as the wind direction contradicted the way the gas supposedly moved on the ground. The U.S. apparently tracked the jet fighters that left the Holmes Air Base and showed their flight path. And that was a major contradiction from the reports, the individual reports that were given from Khan Shaykhun. So there was a major contradiction there in terms of the direction of the jet flight pattern and so forth. So there's all sorts of contradictory evidence that has basically been swept under the rug and ignored. So, you know, those are just a few of the elements. But the big thing here is that if this report is really solid, let's see it. Why are they withholding it?
That really is the $64,000 question, Brian. There's a group, Rick, called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, of which, full disclosure, I'm a member. It's a group of former CIA officers, NSA officers, FBI agents, senior military officers, and we sometimes comment on some of these issues like this one, in which our members have expertise. And we issued a memorandum just after the Khan Shaykhun incident, in which we said essentially what Rick is saying right now, Brian, that that the evidence just wasn't there, that it could have been any number of different factions that carried this out, and that wind direction was something very important that was not being focused on by those accusing the Assad regime of having carried out this attack. Rick, do we know anything more now than we did then that can definitively point to who exactly carried this thing out? Or could this really have been something done by any number of, you know, four or five or six different organizations or governments?
Well, I think the first suspicion of an objective, review would be to suspect the opposition. They're in retreat. They're losing ground to the Syrian army all over the country, and as has been the case for several years, the only way the armed opposition can win is if they drag the U.S. and or NATO into the conflict. So they're the ones who stand to benefit. So that should be seriously looked at. It's pretty significant that the photos and the videos that came out after the event, they've got the so-called Syrian civil defense, a.k.a. white helmets, all over the place. The white helmets are an organization that's kind of a civil arm of Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda in Syria. That was shown from Aleppo, in East Aleppo, when East Aleppo was taken. Through the last several years of the conflict, wherever the white helmets are, they're connected to the al-Qaeda branch in Syria. And one has to be awfully suspicious that we're seeing media deception going on. There's all sorts. They've got a video team and photographers with them wherever they go. So their fingerprints are all over Khan Shaykhun as well. Another thing that I think a skeptical viewer or observer would note is why did Nikki Haley at the United Nations just 3 days ago do a surprise resolution at the UN Security Council calling for the 1 year extension of the joint investigation mechanism team? In other words, the team that has come up with this report today, before now the report still hasn't even been released, but before it was being made, even the news of it was being made public 3 days ago, Nikki Haley, UN ambassador to the United Nations, was demanding a one-year extension of the group. Now, that was basically opposed by Russia and Bolivia, and that led to all sorts of criticism in the media. Basically, if one is a bit of a cynic, one would look at that as kind of a media stunt. If the investigation team is doing good work and one can study their report and see that it's objective, see that they're looking at both sides, see that it's not very biased, Why don't they wait until the report is released before demanding a one-year extension of their mandate?
Yeah, and Russia vetoed that resolution, extending the mandate of the UN and the OPCW.
Right, Russia and Bolivia.
And Bolivia. The new, as you said, John Kiriakou, this new JIM report, the Joint Investigative Mechanism of the Office for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, it's based on the intelligence of U.S., U.K., France, and Israel. These are not unbiased intelligence organizations.
These are not honest brokers in this debate.
Yeah, you just say those words. And, you know, the funny thing is Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson from the U.K. said, Britain condemns the appalling breach of the rules of war and calls for the international community to unite to hold Assad's regime accountable. Not only was Britain the colonizing power in this part of the world, not Syria per se, but they divvied it up with France and France got Syria. But the British were the architects and the, you know, the embracers of the use of chemical weapons. Winston Churchill condemned any British military figure for being soft.
That's
for
right.
Not using chemical weapons when it came to Iraqis and other people in the
forgotten
region.
Forgotten part of history.
Yeah, really. I mean, they love chemical weapons. They were all about chemical weapons. Now it's an appalling breach of the rules of war. Well, it is an appalling breach of the rules of war. We're glad that biological and chemical weapons are banned. But again, let's go back for our audience. The government in Damascus, along with its allies, that's Russia and Iran, have said that the casualties that were caused in April were caused when a conventional airstrike on an Al-Qaeda weapons depot nearly caused an explosion releasing deadly gases. That's what they say.
And that's the conclusion of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity memorandum as well.
Yeah. So they say the Syrian government is hitting Al-Qaeda. You know, it's kind of interesting, Rick, because Americans have been taught since September 11th, 2001, that the war on terror, which is this open-ended blank check for war anywhere, is basically and fundamentally a war against Al-Qaeda. But there's no real dispute that this area was, in fact, held by Al-Qaeda, whatever the new branding it gave, or maybe it had the same branding. And I want to ask you, having said all that, because we only have a few minutes left, not only did the New York Times published this report, a report that they are able to interpret, but we, the public, can't see. But the organization Human Rights Watch gives it extra credibility, too. Human Rights Watch says Syrian chemical findings demand accountability. UN-appointed inquiry blames government for attack. And then the first paragraph of the Human Rights Watch is the United Nations Security Council and Chemical Weapons Convention member countries should take strong measures to ensure accountability after a UN-appointed inquiry found that the Syrian government responsible for an April 2017 chemical attack that killed nearly 100 people. Now, here we have the New York Times, other Western media, media that's hostile to the Syrian government, and the Human Rights Watch, which appears to be a benign, sort of neutral human rights organization, also lending its credibility to the assertion by the report, again, a report we can't yet read. In other words, confirming in the public's mind that this report must be true. Rick Sterling, I remember that Amnesty International, another organization, well-known international organization that represents and defends human rights, played a particular role in the case of the run-up to the Iraq War. The U.S. government was demonizing the Iraqi government. It was trying to build popular support for the war. The Kuwaiti government carried out what was a fabrication, which was the argument that the Iraqi soldiers were coming into Kuwaiti hospitals, ripping Kuwaiti babies out of incubators and taking those incubators back to Baghdad. At that time, Amnesty International endorsed this fabrication, and it thus gave it great, great credence, and it became a main part of the war propaganda leading up to the Iraq War. Tell us, if you would, Rick, about the role, say, of Human Rights Watch in this case.
Well, Human Rights Watch actually released a report regarding the chemical attack that occurred on August 21, 2013. They jumped the gun on that, and before the UN could issue their preliminary findings. Human Rights Watch jumped out with a report saying all the evidence pointed to the Syrian government being responsible. That was later found to be false on a number of counts. The investigative journalist Robert Perry summarized it as a, quote, junk heap of bad evidence, unquote. And one thing about Human Rights Watch is that they've been consistent on the Syrian conflict. They've consistently supported the opposition and basically served as a propaganda vehicle for accusations against the Syrian government. They did it also regarding the so-called Caesar torture photos, where they were the one group, apart from the CIA, that was given access to all of the photos, the 55,000 photos that supposedly showed torture and murder by the Syrian government. And almost half of those photos turned out to be show the opposite. They showed victims of car bombs and attacks by the opposition. And the other ones were very dubious. But nevertheless, Human Rights Watch put forward that as evidence of the brutal Assad dictatorship, as they can repeat over and over. So they've been very biased on this, as has Amnesty International and also Doctors Without Borders. In other words, the big billionaire-funded NGOs, who all have budgets in the hundreds of millions of dollars a year, have been very biased on this score. On some issues, they do good work, but on the Syria conflict, each of those has been consistently bad. And they need to be looked at very skeptically and looked at very, carefully, their reports. Right now, we're seeing a kind of an extension of, we're basically losing, our access to objective information. We've got the attacks on RT and Sputnik. You know, in the spring, we had the prop or not. Baloney published in the Washington Post. We now have the Global Engagement Center that received startup funding in the National Defense Authorization Act signed by President Obama, and it explicitly calls for undermining organizations that present information contrary to U.S. interests. So it's really important that we look at this critically. I highly endorse and support the group that John was referring to, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Their reports are outstanding, and they really hit the nail on the head time after time. I know their reports are published at Consortium News, which is also outstanding. But, you know, on this issue, I think we have to start looking at these accusations skeptically, and we need to say, let's see the evidence. And people who want to get some preliminary information need to review the findings of Seymour Hersh on this subject, of Professor Postol, and also look for Adam Larson's report published at The Indictor, Syria Sarin Allegation, How a UN Panel Report Twists and Omits Evidence, because he's gone over this with a fine-tooth comb, and he's pointing out some glaring contradictions and inconsistencies.
John, there's something about biological and chemical weapons and the allegations about their use that are very useful propagandistically, because they evoke emotional responses. And now, if the United States goes and drops the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan, which it did, 20,000-pound bomb, killing all living things within a one-mile square area, it somehow doesn't evoke like an emotional outrage, or if the U.S. does carpet bombings in Vietnam,
Right.
But any report of, or any visual image of people gurgling and suffering and struggling, like the imagery of chemical weapons and biological weapons is so gross that it's kind of an absolute go-to mechanism if you want to demonize someone. I mean,
it's a great propaganda tactic.
I mean, we're dealing in the era of demonization where, you know, our country or the people who live in the United States just learn who to hate next, and who we learn to hate are the people who have been targeted by the U.S. government for overthrow for the main part.
You're right. I've maintained from the very beginning that Syria is one of those situations where it's possible to not have a good guy, right? Just because you oppose U.S. intervention in Syria doesn't have to mean that you love Bashar al-Assad, right? It's possible to come down on the side of non-intervention and not be allied with whichever side your friends or your colleagues think is the enemy. I think this is one of those situations. You're right, Brian. We ignore things like the mother of all bombs. We ignore things like the world's largest nuclear arsenal. We ignore things like carpet bombs or uranium depleted rockets because of the visuals of chemical attacks. Children lying dead in the street, people with burned skin, people coughing up pieces of their lungs. It's an awful, terrible thing. But we need to see the evidence of who did this, because we can point fingers all we want. It doesn't get us anywhere if we don't have the evidence.
Yeah, and Rick Sterling, as you said, to go back to the beginning, we have just less than 90 seconds. Having a report that says with confidence, we know that, like the same thing about the three intelligence agencies, or were they 17 saying with high degree of confidence, Russia meddled in the election? Confidence is not a fax. Confidence is not proof. And confidence doesn't, you can't offer confidence as proof. 1 minute left. Why don't you go ahead and take us out here?
Yeah. Well, I think that the bottom line is we need to see the report and examine the report to see how solid their evidence is. It's fine for them to have the opinion or for them to be confident, but how persuasive it is it? And especially given that this is being used right now, the signs are this is being used to continue the war. Just today, Rex Tillerson has said Bashar al-Assad has no future as Syria's leader. The bottom line is if we need the restoration of international law, and it's not for Rex Tillerson or you or me to determine who should be Syria's president. That's for the Syrian people to decide. So the real danger here is that this report, which we have not seen yet, which we need to be pretty skeptical of based on some of the things we've raised today, needs to be critically examined to see the evidence. Because right now we can say that it seems to be very, very biased. And if we look at the history of events here, it is more likely than not that this is being used to continue the war against Syria.
We're going to have to leave it there, Rick. We're completely out of time. We've been joined from the Bay Area in California by Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. After a short break, we'll be talking about the major stories of the day in our next hour. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.